inside almost every human mind is a need for security. Maybe there are a few risky souls among us who do not feel that need. But most human beings need to feel secure about today and about the future and about their eternal future. Capitalizing on the human need for security, a whole industry is developed called the insurance industry. And they propose to provide you with security for a certain amount of compensation on your part to them every month. And they advertise and do everything that they can to convince you that you are secure with them, that you're with the good hands people. You know, you can trust them. Or that they are as solid as the rock of Gibraltar and nothing is going to shake it, earthquake or what. You're safe if you're with them. There's another one that has a whole group of cavalry soldiers that blow the trumpet and wave the banner and come charging into your living room on horseback to take care of your needs, giving you the impression that there is an army to protect you. I have been trying to figure out what security there is in the symbol of an elk walking around in my backyard, but the insurance companies wish to sell you security. Man has longed for security ever since the beginning. We go back into the Middle East and archaeologists dig, and as they dig, they find that the ancient cities had great walls around them. Great walls built massive things for the security of the people inside. I was talking with someone last week who was telling me that before he was a Christian, he had an automatic rifle in his house with, now catch this, 5,000 rounds of ammunition. I had no idea who he thought he was going to ward off with that many bullets. But he said that was the security that he had for his family before he met Jesus. There is a certain group of people in our country that teach their people that they should have a year's supply of food stored somewhere in their home for security. We sometimes take security in our savings accounts. But when we notice that our savings accounts are only growing at 5 and 5.5% a year, and inflation is eating them up at 13% a year, it shakes our security. And so people stop having security in green pieces of paper and have turned to gold. Gold now sells at over $300 an ounce. And some people feel that that's a secure way of living, having it. I think that the gas lines that existed in California a few months ago indicated what form some people take for their security. We found that some people were waiting in line 2 and 3 hours to get gasoline, and when they got there, they were unable to put a gallon or 2 gallons of gas in their tank, for their tank was already full. Security is a tank of gasoline. For how long? Until you drive 250 to 300 miles and then all that security is gone. And I somehow notice that the older we get, perhaps the more vulnerable we feel and the greater our need for security. I notice that it seems like the older the people are that I go and visit, the more locks they have on their doors. They're not content with just the regular lock, but they graduate to a chain. And then after that, they graduate to a chain and a bolt plus the lock, and then double locked doors, and on and on. I think perhaps as we find our physical strength weakening and realizing that we would be easy prey for someone, our feeling of vulnerability increases. Some of us listen to the news and listen to our senators and representatives talking about the dangers of SALT II, saying that SALT II was a bad treaty because it threatens the security of the United States. I mean, you know, we can only destroy Russia 500 times over. And wouldn't it be a terrible travesty if we allowed them to gain enough strength to destroy us 600 times over? I somehow have a hard time with the logic of all of that. To me, once you're destroyed, it's over. Whether you can do it 600 times more or not, it's done. Some of us worry about nuclear holocaust. We have a sign right on our church. It says, civil defense area, shelter for so many people, downstairs in the basement. A remnant of the nuclear fear of the 50s, when everyone was waiting for Khrushchev to bury us. We fear those things, and rightly so. A nuclear holocaust is unthinkable. The lucky ones in a nuclear holocaust are the dead ones. The unfortunate ones are the ones who live to perhaps try and clean up the pieces afterwards, only to discover 5 years later that they are dying of leukemia. Perhaps there are so many horrors there that we can't even comprehend them. I'm sure we can't. A need for security. When you're a small child and you're innocent, you have a tremendous amount of security in the physical presence of your parents. The physical size of your father provides you with a tremendous amount of security. There's a certain stage in your life when you believe that your father is the strongest, most powerful man in the world, and that he could even take Muhammad Ali on. But then, as you grow older, that innocence and security begins to wane, and the feeling of vulnerability begins to get stronger and stronger. I have recently been spending some time in the Psalms, and as I read these beautiful pieces that David has written, I have become convinced that David had a tremendous personal need for security in his life, and perhaps rightly so. I mean, you know, there was a time in David's life when, as a shepherd boy, he had to worry about lions and bears eating his flocks. I personally have not encountered too many lions in the last week while walking back and forth from the church. Maybe if they were out there, I would understand David's need for security a little more. It's been a long time since I faced a giant, especially knocked him down with a stone and ran over and cut off his head. Maybe it's been a long time since I've seen giants in the land, at least that kind. There's other kinds that are walking around. It's been a long time in my life since I have had the king personally set out to capture me because he was jealous of me. I read about David fleeing because Saul wanted to take his life. I haven't had to hide in caves out in the wilderness. I haven't had to have men rally around me to tell me that they will support me and protect me. Because even as courageous as David was, there were times when Saul came after him with 3,000 men. There was one time when David was almost completely surrounded by Saul and his men. And as far as David was concerned, it was all over. And just as Saul was pressing in to close for that final capture, a messenger came running to tell Saul that the Philistines had attacked the country at a different part and he had to take his soldiers and be gone. David rescued at the last moment. I must confess to you honestly, though, that as I read about David and as courageous as he was, and as beautiful as some of the Psalms are that he wrote, I have a hard time appreciating David's character. I have come to the conclusion that David was not a Christian. You'll say, well, obviously he wasn't. There weren't any Christians yet. But what I mean by that is that in many ways, David was not a very Christ-like individual. He was a very vengeful person. He's out in the wilderness and he needs help. He needs food for it. So he sends a message to a very wealthy man who had adequate to provide David with food. But the man sent a very spiteful message back that he was not about to feed David. And David immediately sets off with his men to do this dear fellow in. And if it hadn't been for that fellow's wife who sent out food and came and placated David, David was going to go out and destroy this man. Very, very unchristlike. David finally ends up not only taking the man's food, finally ended up taking the man's wife. Not very Christ-like. As you go on and on and you read about wife after wife that David accumulates to himself and his irresponsible actions with his children, you have to come to the conclusion that David was not a very good man. And yet we find all through Scripture God staying faithfully beside this fellow. Some of you might be saying in your mind, but David was very gracious at times. There was a time when David and his men were hiding in this cave and Saul and his men were coming along and Saul in the heat of the day was looking around for a private place and he looked up and he saw this cave and excused himself from his men. And he went up on into this cave and he got up there and it was dark inside, the hot, bright noonday sun out there. And Saul came in and he couldn't see into the back of the cave, had no idea that David and his men were in the back of that cave, breathing as quietly as they could. And there stands Saul all by himself, unarmed, without his men by. Saul turns around, sits down and faces the bright sunlight. Easy prey for David. David could have slipped up behind him very easily and slipped in the knife. Matter of fact, he did slip up behind him and cut off a piece of his garment while Saul is sitting there wide awake, looking out the valley. Another occasion, Saul is sleeping, surrounded by his 300 men. David slips into the camp. He comes right beside Saul. He stands right over him. And it's so easy to take that spear and drive it down through his heart and pin him into the ground. He chooses not to. He merely takes the spear and Saul's water bag and goes off away from the camp and then calls back to let Saul know that he's been there. You say it's a very gracious, very magnanimous act on David's part. But I really wonder. I really wonder how magnanimous David was being, or if David was smart enough to being able to take care of David, because the reason that David kept using for not killing Saul when he had these two perfect opportunities was he kept saying, "How dare someone touch the Lord's anointed?" Now, wait a minute. There happened to be two individuals in the land who are the Lord's anointed. One of them was Saul, and one of them was David himself. David is setting a precedent. David is saying, you don't touch the Lord's anointed. Nobody kills the Lord's anointed. Is he graciously sparing Saul's life, or is he establishing a precedent that he knows he will need someday to protect his own life? If David kills Saul, is David then saying it's all right to kill the Lord's anointed and making it easy for someone to assassinate him someday? What about the man who came to David after Saul had died on Mount Gilboa? And the messenger came and he lied, but David didn't know he was lying, but he lied and he said that he was the one that had taken Saul's life. And what did David do? David turned around and had that man killed. He had that man killed not because the man had told a lie, but because the man had said that he had lifted his hand against the Lord's anointed. We say, well, David changed as the years went by. But did David change as the years went by? David is laying on his deathbed. And one of the very last instructions that David gives is that certain man who had cursed him years before, that he and his entire family be killed. And the soldiers went out, and when David's dying breath killed a man and his entire family to take vengeance. What is it about this David? What is it about this man who kills and commits adultery? What is it about this man that he can elicit such obvious affection from the Lord? What is it about this man who can bring God's favor upon him when his own life and character seems so ungodlike? I've often wondered. I think maybe the Psalms help us. I'd like you to turn and look at some of the Psalms quickly with me this morning. I'd like you to start with Psalm verse 7. And as we look at Psalm verse 7, I think that we will see that despite the fact that David had all of these character faults, and maybe I've been too harsh on him because I don't understand the culture in which David grew up. I don't understand all of the obvious killing and everything that was going on around David, and perhaps the necessity for David to do all of these things for him to survive and for his people to survive. But I do know something about David as I read the Psalms, and I know that David had a tremendous capacity for repentance. But when David would do these things, he would feel sorry about it. And he would come back to the Lord, and he would plead with the Lord to take care of his gross sins. And there was something about David that David knew about himself. Despite all of the things that David was doing, David realized that he could not trust anybody around him or himself. David did not trust the mighty fortress walls of Jerusalem. He didn't trust the fortress walls of his own palace inside the city. But David continually throughout his Psalms recognized that it was by God and God's power that David was surviving. I want you to notice verse 1 of Psalm 7. O Lord my God, in thee do I put my trust. Save me from all them that persecute me and deliver me. He's crying out for help from God, but he's stating the fact that he trusts God. Look at chapter 11. Psalm 11, verse 1. A very repetitious thought. In the Lord put I my trust, he says. Turn to Psalm 16, verse 1. Preserve me, O God, for in thee do I put my trust. Look at Psalm 18, verse 1 and 2. I will love thee, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock, my fortress, my deliverer, my strength, in whom I will, what? Trust. Psalm 23. The 23rd Psalm, we all know so much by heart. He says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. A statement of trust. Psalm 27, verse 1. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked, even mine enemies and my foe, came up unto me to eat my flesh, they stumbled and fell. Though an host should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this will I be confident. One thing have I desired of the Lord that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For in the time of trouble, he shall hide me in his pavilion. In the secret of his tabernacle shall he hide me. He shall set me up upon a rock. Let's look at Psalm 31. Verse 1. In thee, O Lord, do I put my trust. And let's turn to Psalm 91. Perhaps the most beautiful of all of the Psalms of God's trust. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. And I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge, my fortress, my God. In him will I trust. For all of the mental qualms and questions I have about David and his character, there is one thing that seems to ring clear. And that is that David knows for sure who his God is. And David has placed absolute confidence in that God to see him through. I believe that Paul had the same experience. And maybe this is the one thing about Paul that makes him like David. For Paul tells us that neither death, nor life, nor hell, nor principalities, nor powers of darkness, nothing would be able to separate him from the love of his Jesus Christ. This all tells me something today, because Paul himself was a murderer. It tells me something today that I really believe that I can pass on to you, my people, this morning with confidence. I believe this morning, that if you are looking for security, don't look to Prudential or State Farm. If you are looking for security, don't look for what any human being can do for you. But put your faith and trust in God. Make the Father and his Son Jesus your personal fortress. And though the economy should go down the drain and all of your savings should disappear, and though you would lose your home, and though you would lose your car, and though you would lose your health, I stand before you this morning to tell you that those are not the important things in life. And that no matter how many sins you have committed, maybe we have sitting in our congregation this morning a secret murderer. It is very possible that we have someone in our family right here who has deliberately taken another human being's life. And maybe you have been plagued with guilt. And maybe you have felt that God could never really save you, but you have continued to come and worship out of some desperate hope. Let me tell you, you don't have to be a desperate murderer, okay? But I want to assure you that if God could save Paul and give Paul the assurance that nothing could separate him, if God could put up with that murdering, adultering David, then I am convinced this morning that God can put up with you. And that God can tolerate me. And I believe that the secret to it is trusting him. David trusted him. Paul trusted him. And I believe this morning that if we will trust him, then we will have not just security here, but we will have eternal security. And I long very much for you to leave this sanctuary this morning, believing and knowing in your heart that you are saved. It upsets me when I talk with you. And here you tell me that you hope you're going to be saved, but you're not sure. I want you to know that you can trust God this morning.
Yes.
That he is faithful and he will not let you down. And that you can go home this afternoon and enjoy this Sabbath day, not fearing for the future things of this world, but trusting in the future things of the eternal world.
Yes.
And knowing that they're yours. Jesus is my God. Jehovah is my God. The Holy Spirit is my God. And in him, on this frightful day, do I put my trust.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. American Christian Ministries is not a one-man band. It is an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.